My name is Deanne Lagerquist. I teach at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. There are two colleges in Northfield, which maybe Kathy told you a little bit before she graduated from the other school, Carleton, which is on the other side of the river, although she started at St. Olaf. I've been there 7 years, so I'm just coming off of a wonderful sabbatical, which I say I spent in a small room in the library with dead people, old books, and new technology. I was writing and I'm still in the process of writing a history of American Lutheranism. As I listened yesterday, as you identified yourself, I realized that I ought not be making assumptions about what you'll know about Lutheranism. But you may find me making lots of references, because that's my principal research area right now. But you know, we'll cope with that as it goes along. Really, that's not the main thing we'll talk about. This is my sixth full summer to spend at Holden Village, doing various things, from working in the library, but mostly working with the program in various capacities. My husband runs the Portal Museum. My son greets the bus most days. He's 3 years old, and it's his fourth summer at Holden Village. He first came when he was 10 weeks old and stayed 12 weeks. So when he left, he'd had over half his life at Holden Village. We think this accounts for the fact that he's something of an extrovert. Okay. As I was saying before some of you came in, I'm more often told to speak more quietly than to speak more loudly. So if I need to speak more loudly, I'll be flattered. Okay, so don't be embarrassed to tell me that I need to speak more loudly. I am frequently told to speak more slowly. And if that becomes an issue, please tell me to speak more slowly. I'm not doing this for my own benefit. I want you to participate with me. Also, I should say, as I'm sure Tom and Kathy did, feel free at any time to break in with comments or questions or to expand on something that I'm saying. Everyone I know who's taught Elder Hostel has assured me that that's not really a problem.
Now, I don't know, but we have two new people.
Since you've met. Have you come since? Is this your first session?
Yeah, first session.
Well, then I think we should stop and let you at least introduce yourselves. If you would. Yesterday, Carrie had a wonderful way of having us introduce ourselves by commenting about a favorite article of clothing we've had in our lives. So maybe you'd be willing to attach that to your name and where you're from.
Well, you'll usually see me in a hat, because I like hats. I didn't bring my favorite with me, but anyway. I'm Dorothy Ramslin from Bellingham, Washington. Mm-hmm. And my friend?
I'm Ruth Houston from West Des Moines, Iowa.
Really?
I don't know what my favorite item is. I have not worn this necklace and earrings until this trip, and I have had more comments on it, so I decided I should wear it more often.
Yeah. And maybe we should also just take time for the rest of you to say your names, for Ruth and
Dorothy.
Can
I just ask how they're friends? I mean,
well, I don't know. That's kind of personal.
College roommates.
Oh, that's great.
50 years ago, undergraduate roommates at the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, that's great. Okay, let's start with you, Tony, and just quickly around the room with names.
Tony Agger from Vancouver, Washington.
Bobby Parsons from Houston, Texas.
Andy Parsons from Houston.
Frank Donner, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Jane Donner, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Jackie Hanson from Mesa, California.
Ken Hanson from Mesa, California.
Don Delbleach from Seattle, Washington.
Grace Brandis, Vancouver, Washington.
Betty Ron from Portland, Oregon.
Sue Odebakke from Senator, Oregon.
Lena Maples from Huntington Beach, California.
Virginia Rush from Vancouver, Washington.
Jean Matthews from Vancouver.
Washington.
I'm Louise Ogle from Port Orchard, Washington.
Camilla Slack, Jerseyton, Washington.
And Larry Wickern from Fallbrook, California.
And Brenda Wickern.
Okay.
Thank you all for taking the extra.
Oh, I'm glad to do it. Still, I won't remember all your names.
Right.
I'm sorry, I'm slow on that. What I thought we'd do today is really to do what's in the preface and introduction of a book. Talk a little bit about the topic generally, our method of study, and then something about Christianity in its early years, particularly looking at community. This is a topic that I've been interested in for a very long time, at least since I was in college. I suppose before that you don't think about things like this. And I guess some of the things I'd say about my interest are these. One of my interest in the topic of Christianity and community comes from a strong awareness that who I am depends a great deal on who I'm with. Now, this is a sort of truism that our parents throw at us when we're about 14, right? That who you hang out with says something about who you are. And at that point, you bristle, you know, and say, no, I'm my own person. But it turns out to be true, doesn't it? That the kind of people you hang around with eventually shapes who you are. And there is also some truth to that as you move from one group to another, you may act a little bit differently. People talk about coming to Holden in this way. Some people say, I come to Holden and I get to think things I never get to think at home. I get to try out new things. I get to wear a new piece of jewelry. Because at home, people would be saying, where did you get that jewelry? That doesn't look like you, right? You never wear green. What are you doing wearing green? You're messing up my preconceptions about who you are. But in a new place, you start to become a new person. So that's one reason I'm interested. I also am convinced that what I believe is shaped in the same way, that the people with whom I live and with whom I interpret my life and their lives shape very much what I believe and how I respond to my life. Now, neither of these things is intended to be a denial of God's work in making me who I am, in making you who you are, or God's work in what we believe. I think it's a common Christian confession that we come to believe through God's work. But then we start to ask, well, what's the vehicle of God's work? What is the way that this living water is brought to us? What's the vessel? One of my favorite ways of talking about theology is to say it's the vessel in which the water is carried to us. And to a certain extent, it doesn't matter which vessel it is if it gets there, but that's not to deny that there's some difference between a coffee cup like this or a lovely China teacup. So that's something about my interest in this topic. And of course, the fact that I've spent all this summer time at Holden, which is very different from winter time at Holden, also contributes to my interest. There's a very basic issue for most people is how to live a good life. For Christian people, we might state that a little bit more precisely to ask about how to live a godly life. How do you live a godly life? And what do other people contribute to that godly life? That's another way of coming at this question. What do Christianity and community have to do with each other? How do the people we are with shape us? That's maybe even too external of a verb. But how do the people we're with contribute to our identity as Christians and contribute to our beliefs? Well, I would say, having listened yesterday to what you said about your own religious affiliations, that probably for almost everyone in this room, the beginning point of baptism as infants is an important way that begins. That other people bring us to the font. And I don't know which kind of Baptist you are, so I don't know if that's the case in your tradition. We had happen at my congregation in Northfield this spring something I used to make up in class when I talked about baptism, namely a child who shrieked violently when brought to the font. And sure enough, the pastor said to this kid, I'm sorry, but we're doing it anyway. Right? So that one of the ways we become Christians is that someone lugs us up there and speaks on our behalf and essentially says, this is a good way to be a human being. This is a good enough way to be a human being that I'm willing to do it for you before you can even choose. Another way that other people contribute to our living of a godly life is through supporting us during our lives, in our worship, in instruction, in counseling, and so forth. And the third way, I would say, is in our response to other people, so that it's not all receiving. It's also giving, that it's in the opportunities that we have to share our faith and our beliefs and our values and so forth, that we are shaped, right? They say that the best way to learn patience is to practice it. Well, you can't practice it on your own. You really need someone who irritates you to learn patience. Well, most people, I have to work on it even without irritating people. But okay, so today we'll look at community in a general way, some attention to the early church, and then the rest of the days we'll look at four examples. You see them laid out before you, so I won't write them on the board. Monasticism, primarily Benedictines, the Amish, the Shakers, and base Christian communities. The idea will be that we'll learn about them and from them. Okay. The rhythm of the days then will be somewhat different from today, where I'm going to start out just right now and ask you to talk a little bit to each other and to me. Usually we'll save that for the end, but today we'll start that at the beginning. So this is what I'd like you to do, a two-part exercise. The first part will be individual, and the second part will be with two or three other people. The first thing I want you to do is to make a list. Okay? List people who make you who you are. Okay? Make you you. You know, three or four or six, or however many you want to list quickly. And then do a little analysis of those people. Ask yourself, what do they have in common? Of course, besides this, this is the obvious thing they all have in common. And then, are they a community? Okay, why don't you take about 5 minutes for the first step? Yeah.
For me.
Either one. Make.
Today.
Or made. Either one. Yeah.
Are we still looking at individually?
Individually. If you can write it down if you want, or you can do it in your head.
What would be categories?
No, individuals. Think of specific people. Human impulse and a necessity for all human beings. This is, first of all, a biological fact that a human infant is born in such a state of dependence and vulnerability that left alone, it will die. It can't get its own food, can't do anything really for itself except cry out and respond to care. So first of all, at some very fundamental biological level, we could say in some way community is a basic biological need for all humans. But more than that, Community is a basic cultural need because we not only learn from other people, we not only receive from other people sustenance, we learn how to be a human being. Those of you who have raised children, who have watched other people raise children, know that this is very, very true. You watch me with my three-year-old. I'm working all the time saying, no, people don't eat with dirty hands, right? No, civilized people try to sit still in church. You know, there are all these things that are about how we are. And they vary from culture to culture. This is a very well-traveled group, and you could multiply for me examples of how we learn to be a specific kind of human being, right? You can multiply those internationally. You can also probably multiply them in your own family, right? That if some of you suddenly have a new roommate here, you begin to realize that there are many ways to be human. Some people fold their towel and some people scrunch them up. Some people keep them for weeks, you know. Okay. But we not only need each other to be able to eat, but we need each other to learn to be human. And this is an ongoing need. It doesn't stop when we reach the age of 16 and get a driver's license, or 18 and can vote, or 21, which doesn't get you anything new anymore. We have ongoing need for each other. These are psychological needs. We talk about being lonely. They're economic needs, not to the same extent that they once were. My youngest brother lives in St. Paul. He has his own apartment. He has his own car. He has his own microwave, his own stereo system. He has everything of his own. He can function as an economic unit in our American society. Some of my relatives came from Scandinavia in the 19th century. You could not function as an economic unit by yourself, as an individual, in that economy. It was impossible. Right? In our society, it's possible, and yet you're always one step behind, depending on somebody. Right? At Holden, one of the things that's wonderful is that that becomes more obvious to us. You see the people who are in the kitchen making the food. If you're here very long, you get your turn sorting garbage. Right? It gives you a whole new understanding of how the world works. You know, and you're thinking, why did they buy this? Why are they throwing that away? It's an ongoing need for others, economic, psychological, and many other ways, intellectual. Different people have these needs on different, you know, it's more one kind than another for different people. There are also, however, degrees, and this comes to my next point, there are degrees of togetherness, right? There's the collectivity of an apartment building or a condominium association. It's kind of utilitarian, right? We all live in the same place. We all pay the same maintenance fees. We all have the same swimming pool. You know, we all have the same plantings in front of our house. But it's that community. They talk about it as a planned community. There's the totality of village life. Not this kind of village life, but Tom Perry told me as we were driving over here about going out into the remote areas of Indonesia, where he visited some place where there's a language of 200 speakers. Now, that begins to make you know you're a community. You are the only 200 people in the world who speak this language. And maybe you speak no other language, right? So you depend on each other for everything. And then there are intersections of various groups defined in various ways. So there are the people you work with, right? And the people you're related to, and that's probably a pretty small overlap. Your family. It depends on the kind of place you work. if you work in the church, depending on how you define your work, you may be related to a lot of people because churches tend to have a big overlap with families. There's also then church, and it may be that there's some overlap there too. I have some colleagues at St. Olaf who deliberately joined a church in another town because they said they hated going to church and feeling like they were at a faculty meeting. Now, I thought that was rather charming. I like going up to the communion rail and looking across and seeing someone in another department, or even someone from my department with whom I've had an argument that week. Okay, it puts it in a different perspective. I like that. But some people find that constraining. And we could multiply this. There may be the people who have tickets to the same... My brother has tickets to the St. Paul Saints minor league baseball team. You know, so there's some interest group. It might be who you have tickets with. My husband plays on a volleyball team. It may be the people who have the same series at the symphony as you. And every time you go, they're sitting right there next to you. These overlap in various ways. And this is very different from village life, where it's all like this, right? Everybody overlaps, the total community. This is, I think, why we feel a little fragmented. Because there is no group where everybody intersects. I heard Ray Suarez, maybe some of you listened to Talk of the Nation on NPR, broadcasting from the Mall of America recently, and some guy who was on there said, well, I really like to come to the Mall of America because I feel like I'm in the midst of my community. Well, and Suarez, you know, in his lovely way said, but it's all commercialized. The guy said, yeah, but I see people I never see anywhere else, you know. Olded Village is another kind of community. It's a peculiar community, and probably already you've begun to feel that. We have a vocabulary. Have you noticed any strange words we use here?
Yeah.
Like what?
What's maverick?
A maverick. A maverick is a person who does all various kinds of physical labor. Loads and unloads the truck, sometimes drives the truck, chops wood. If we have a sewage backup, they have to go and dig up the road and undo the pipe and shovel and that kind of stuff. They have to light the river sauna. That's what a maverick is.
Okay. Garbologist.
A garbologist? Yeah. Well, the garbologist is the person who organizes all the volunteers. In the summer, usually you get garbology once a month. And so you need someone who makes that work. The garbologist is the person who knows the routine, who says, now you do this to the boxes, now you sort into these piles, these kinds of plastics we recycle, these kinds get buried, who burns the stuff in the incinerator, who, when we have melon, stands up and makes an announcement, please cut your melon pieces, rinds, into very small pieces. They compost more quickly. We call buildings by odd names. Koinonia, agape, the VC,
Narnia,
right? It's where the kids program is called Narnia, from C.S. Lewis. Right?
Oh yeah.
Right.
That's
yeah. And in the old days, there was a guy who I've never met him, but I've heard a lot about him. It was kind of a distinguished tall theologian who taught at Concordia St. Louis, who would lay down on the floor and read the Chronicles of Narnia to the children. That's another thing that helps us with community is we have history together. We have stories together. We heard two people who went to college together, Bobby told us about having a slumber party with her high school friends. There's a history that we share together. That's something else that gives us community. Sometimes it's intensity. Several of you spoke about being in the military. I think there's a kind of intensity of common experience that makes community happen fast. And a couple of you also talked about being married into the military and moving a lot, that creates a different kind of community where you're careful maybe about what you reveal to each other when. Well, we could go on and on forever about this. But what I wanted to say is that few of us experience this kind of total community. Very few Americans have that kind of experience. But I think many of us long for something less fragmented than what we've got. We long for something where, as they say on Cheers, everybody knows your name. Right? Not all the time. We are, after all, individualistic Americans. But once in a while, we'd like to have that. So if I said, you cannot be human alone, then the next question is, can you be religious alone? There are a lot of people who think you can. Lots of my students think they can be religious alone, although usually then they don't want to be religious, they want to be spiritual. Right? Because to be religious, they think, means you have to have something to do with church. And what they don't want is anything to do with church. Can you be a Christian alone? I would say no to both of those questions. You cannot be religious by yourself, and you cannot be a Christian by yourself, although I would give slightly different reasons. Now, we've been 45 minutes. This is a natural break, or we can go about 10 more and take a break at another natural breaking space. What feels good to you?
A little break now?
Okay. Stand up, walk around. We'll start in. Let's try and be back by 10 after.
They can worship God on the golf course.
Yep. And that's precisely the case I'm talking about.
I would say absolutely no, you can't be a Christian alone, but it's very hard.
Yep. Yeah, and you might be able to do that a few times. Yeah, that's right. And this will probably continue, that dialogue will continue as we go along. First, I would let me take on the question about can you be religious alone. William James, in his book Varieties of Religious Experience, one of those classics in the study of religion, wrote this around the turn of the century. He's usually thought of as a psychologist, says that religion is the thing that you do with your solitude. And so I'm arguing with a pretty big name when I say, no, you can't be religious alone. But I want to acknowledge that there are people who think that religion is what you do by yourself. Okay, when left to your own devices, that's religion is what's left. I go more with a living scholar of religion. Her name is Catherine Albanese. She teaches at the University of California in Santa Barbara. And in a textbook on American religion, she uses, in her introduction, a description of religion that has four parts. The first is community. And then the other three parts are all things that the community shares. A creed, a cultus, and a code. Now let me unpack that a little bit. By creed, she means a set of beliefs. Or to put it even less technically, how these people answer the big questions. Right? What does it mean to be human? Where did life come from? The sorts of dark night of the soul and naive child questions. That's the creed. So it doesn't have to be a formal creed like the Apostles' Creed. It can be stories or mythology or hymnody. There are a lot of ways that we express our beliefs, but one of the things that a religious community shares is a creed. Then the second thing that she tells us that a religious community shares is a cultus. And obviously she's looking for alliterations, right? You could also use here ritual. Right? The community shares activities that they do together in a repeated way. Now, there's a scholar of church music who I heard speak recently, and he said, I thought, quite rightly, if you get a group of people together twice, they'll start repeating themselves. So the question of ritual is, what do we repeat? What do we repeat on purpose? What do we repeat unintentionally? And then also, what do we repeat, particularly in the context of worship, but not only? Holden is filled with rituals, right? Meeting the bus, right? I came out there today and sat down on the grass waiting for the bus. Someone came up to me and said, well, there she is in her summer spot. That's where you find Ann, a 12:45, waiting for the bus. It's no less a Holden ritual than going to Vespers every night. Right? The way we eat meals is another kind of ritual. There are certain things that we do that shape our day. And then the third thing that Albanese says we share is code. And here you could use, as a synonym, ethics. This is how we define what's good and bad. What kind of behavior is allowed, and what kind of behavior is not allowed. Right. These are things that people share. And now I've written these out in a nice linear way, but more appropriately, I couldn't quite figure out a way not to erase the creative circle, but I thought, oh, how nice, Kathy's working with a circle. I'd say we also have a circle for these four parts, and it actually goes in both directions, so that the community shapes what you believe, and there should be some congruence between these, right? You hope that your rituals don't contradict your beliefs, right? You hope that your ethics flow out of the cultus. In the current Lutheran liturgy, the last things that's said is, go in peace, serve the Lord. And the idea is that here you've been fed at the Lord's table, and now you go out and do that, so that there's a close linkage there. So creed and code and cultus, they don't necessarily have to go in this order. I need really a three-dimensional sphere to show the dynamic of that. And even that wouldn't really work, because it's not always a closed system, right? So that you may belong to a particular community, but you read about somebody else's worship service and you think, yeah, those people might be Muslims, but they sure got a good idea. And can we retool that? Can we do a little something, you know? Can we take that ancient antique armoire and make it into a VCR cabinet, right? We do this sort of stuff all the time. We get things from the outside. So there's a certain amount of permeability as well. Based on this kind of understanding, you can't be religious alone, not for very long. The very notion that you would be religious probably comes from somewhere. Right? The particular way that you're religious comes from somewhere. You might be able, as you suggested, Andy, to go out somewhere by yourself for a while and practice that. And those people who say, I can worship God just as well on the golf course as anywhere else, well, someone gave them the idea of God. They probably didn't just make that up. Now, there may be a human impulse to think that there is a God, but the particular way they think of God has been shaped by people who've told them, God is like this. I've experienced God in that way. So, no, I don't think that you can really say that you can be religious alone.
What does it mean to be religious?
Oh. Well, yeah. Did I lose a page?
Sorry, it was that day.
Oh, no, it was so
That's a good thing.
Oh, that's the next thing. Okay. There it is. I love the student who asked the question that takes you to the next point. It means we're done with one, and it's time to move on. Okay. Now, there are zillions of definitions of religion. William James says it's what you do in your solitude. Kathy Albanese tries to describe it in this way from the outside. It's the history of religions approach, that you don't explain it from the inside, you look at it from the outside. I tend to work with a kind of functional definition, which is religion is what gives meaning to life and the way that we make sense out of life. So that I would say religion is a lot about meaning and interpretation. Yeah, when something happens, how you fit that into the world, right?
Repeat that, religion is what?
How you give meaning to life and make sense of life. Because the same thing can happen, similar things can happen to three people and they might make a different meaning out of it, right? And for example, one of the things that's very peculiar about Christianity is that having had baptism, we say, you've already died, so you will never die again. Death means life. Well, this is a very strange thing to say. But most good funeral sermons tell you death isn't death. Death means life. Even while we acknowledge that death breaks the community and that there's loss. Right, as Susan said so well in her sermon last night. But we change the meaning. What's death about? Well, we say death isn't about death. Death isn't about the end. Death is about the beginning. I watched this recently. One of my friends and colleagues at St. Olaf is from one of those families where you just think, can another bad thing happen? When she was about 25, her father died from a sudden heart attack. 3 years later, her mother gets early onset of Alzheimer's. Her cousin dives into a swimming pool and becomes a paraplegic. What happened next? Her brother-in-law had a brain tumor, just died this spring. You know, it's just like, what more can happen? She had a stillbirth followed by 3 miscarriages. You just think, she's not even 40. How can this happen to someone? Well, how do you make meaning of that? How do you make sense of that? That's what religion, I would argue, is about. In a general, generic way, and of course having said that, there's no such thing as a generic religion as there's no generic human beings. This giving of meaning to life and making sense of it happens in consort with other people who share, if not the same experience, at least similar interpretation. Okay, so when I sit down soon to write a note to this woman's sister, who I also know, the fact that I know she is a Christian, that I know her husband who died, who was up here as a baker some years ago, a wonderful baker, splendid baker. I know what to say to them, right? I know what to say to them. To one of my dearest friends from graduate school, who is not a Christian, when her parents died, I didn't quite know what to say, right? I could tell her how I would make sense of that. And in a sense, that's my gift to her. But she won't make sense of it in the same way. Now, it's one of the weird things about community that there have been big decisions in my life when I've turned to that woman and said, talk to me about it, even though we don't share this other deep thing. So there's weird things that happen. Okay, it's also about how we organize life. The way we make sense and give meaning has pragmatic consequences, right? About how we organize our day. Catherine Albanese says religion is about boundaries, where we draw lines and how we cross lines. Okay, so the example about death is about transcending boundaries. How do you get across this boundary between life and death? How do you get across other kinds. Life cycle is really a good example of crossing boundaries, because first you're a child, and then you become something between a child and adult. And it used to be that confirmation was supposed to help you make that transition. Right? It doesn't work so well anymore, because the transition from being a child to being an adult comes at a different time in our culture than it used to. And it may also not work so well anymore because of that diagram I drew where there wasn't very much overlap. Right? So that the ritual of getting your driver's license seems much more profound sign of being an adult. We also organize our lives in terms of time. The day, look at the Benedictines, the day is very clearly laid out. At Holden, the day is very clearly laid out. That's one of the things that makes you exhausted. People are always expecting you to be somewhere. And you try to remember, where is it I'm supposed to be? And half the time you have two choices, and then you have to make a decision, and that's exhausting. But the way you make sense of life shows in how you use your time. What are you willing to give your time to? We have this kind of unhappy discussion in our household about that volleyball team that my husband plays on, you know, two nights a week. I wanted to do it. I know he makes him happy, and it kind of bugs me. Like, but couldn't you stay home with me? Don't I matter more than volleyball? Right? And he's, well, yeah, but he still goes to volleyball. How you use your time. Also, an annual ritual, or an annual cycle. And Christians have this. Advent, Christmas, Epiphany, Lent, Easter, Pentecost, ordinary time. Summer is sort of odd, the green weeks. The way we organize our work and our recreation, these also are about how we organize our lives. Some people make a clear division between the sacred and the secular, or the profane. Albanese, this is one of the interesting things about any religion, is how much they let be outside of religion. And until the mid-60s or early 70s, the going thesis was that as we moved more and more to modernity, less and less of our lives came under the sway of religion. Right? This is the secularization theory. So all that you did that was religious was what you did on Sunday morning for an hour so you could be done before the football game. And if you were a person whose whole life was organized by religion, this was regarded as somewhat odd. I dated a guy in graduate school who really did think I was quite odd because of this. Because he studied Buddhist, but he wasn't religious himself. And so I always felt like it was okay to let him pay for my dinner because he was doing field research. He was meeting someone whose whole life was organized by her religion, that I really believed stuff. And that there wasn't very much secular that didn't have something sacred about it. Okay. But the way people divide that varies a great deal. And one of the things I think you'll see about the four communities that we look at is that for them, there isn't much outside of religion. Everything is influenced by religion. Or nothing. I had a student who studied the Amish, and he came to me and said, there's nothing religious about these people. Everything is, the things that make them different are just, you know, what they wear and stuff. Well, most of us, probably what we wear, we don't think of as something religious. But for some people, it is. Okay. We talked about the cyclical relationship. Okay, I'll just take a, before I move on to Christianity, in case you want to say, oh, I'm never going to get through this. We'll leave early Christianity till tomorrow. We'll just talk about Christianity in general today. So if you want to say something about religion in general, here's a break.
Could I comment on something?
Yes, please do.
Yeah, and our, you know, when we're baptized, we really feel we're being baptized in Christ. And
yeah.
Yeah, I'm saying. When I was in Pittsburgh on Ash Wednesday, I went to church with our son, and their church is rather formal, Lutheran. After the third part of the service, the pastor did have the cross
in position of ashes
on each of our foreheads. And it was really very profound for me to parade around in front of the pastor with some 200-300 other people, and with each one of us, you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Mm-hmm. Each of us came back with the lashes on our forehead, reminding us that we are more.
Yeah.
And I really think that is one profound thing about Christian faith, that from early on, we are told that we will die.
Mm-hmm.
I think so many people like to go through life not really looking at that.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to live forever, somehow. But, you know, they're not going to have to face death in this life. And that's not what
is that peculiar to the Christian faith?
I don't know if it's, I don't know if it's necessarily. Well, but if you, in a religion that that has karma and reincarnation, death is a different kind of a beginning. Every religion has to respond to death.
Of course they do.
Yeah. But our way of responding is at least distinguishing, if not unique. Right?
Because it helps you appreciate then the life right. that we're sure of in
right.
Christ.
So that we say to be, when you become a Christian, you die. You're baptized into Christ's death. I've heard of a Latin American custom in some places where they bring in the water for the font in a child's coffin. you think, oh, that's just a little much, but it's what we say. And the Baptists who practice immersion make this much clearer. I mean, Lutherans and other mainstream Protestants, we kind of clean this up, you know. It looks like washing the spit up off their face. And a little drop here, a little drop here. But when they go under the water, have you ever read Flannery O'Connor's short story, The Baptism? Oh, it's just, oh. Really heartrending about a little child who goes to a baptism on a riverbank, and they baptize him, and he hears this language about death, and he thinks that he should float away. He thinks he should really die. I can't read it very often because it's really. So I don't know that I don't know enough about other religions to say definitely.
I don't either. I was putting that in a firm question. Well, in Martin Luther's time, didn't they immerse the babies?
I don't know the answer to that.
That is huge.
Yeah, but I don't know that they put you all the way in. I just don't know the answer to that.
When it wasn't freezing cold.
It was cold water.
Yeah, it was cold water, no doubt.
I can't believe it.
None of this warmed water.
Okay.
Well, look, that's a nice transition then to talk about why Christianity finds community to be crucial. One reason I would argue that Christianity finds community to be crucial is because of the commandments Jesus makes to us. Jesus' command to love one another, to love the neighbor, these force us beyond ourselves. Right? If Jesus says the greatest commandment is to love God and the second is to love your neighbor as yourself, if you don't have contact with somebody else, you've only gotten half of it, right? The text we had last night about being bound together in this great giveaway, right? It really demands some kind of community. And then the great commission that we get at the end of Matthew to go and tell others also propels us from ourselves. Right. There's also the precedent of the Jewish notion of peoplehood. Christianity is, in its origin, a sort of Judaism. In the early Christian, in the period of early Christianity, that's how it was regarded, as a kind of Judaism. And the Jews have this notion of peoplehood. God didn't come only to Abraham, but to Abraham and Sarah and their descendants, right? So that we hear of the God of Abraham and Jacob, of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. I really do know it. that it's a people. It's always lots of people. It's never just you. Now, partly that has to do with the anthropology of the time, right? Because that was an economic system in which you couldn't live by yourself. But we've taken that with us. Christianity is a historical religion. What I mean by this is not only that it's old, but that as Christians, we see the vehicle of God's working in very specific times and places. It's incarnational. Even as God is present to us in the scandalous specificity of Jesus, so God acts in local contexts. This is to give another Lutheran example, the Lutheran view of the sacraments, not only Lutherans, but certainly Lutherans, is that the finite, the ordinary, can carry the infinite or the extraordinary. Right? That it's possible for the ordinary things of water, bread, and wine to bring to us God's forgiveness. So, even so, as that woman, Susan, quoted last night, people like us, right? We can give that to one another and receive from one another. And in that regard, I want to just give you a few passages from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You may know that this is, you've probably been hearing, the 50th anniversary of Bonhoeffer's martyrdom. He wrote this little book called Life Together. There are a few copies of it, as well as the Larry Rasmussen book in the bookstore. It was for a seminary community, sort of a seminary in exile, early in the Nazi era. And in his first chapter, he says, we belong to each other only through and in Jesus Christ. What does this mean? It means first that a Christian needs others because of Jesus Christ. It means second that a Christian comes to others only through Jesus Christ. It means third that in Jesus Christ we have been chosen from eternity, accepted in time, and united for eternity. This is something that's important about Christian community, is that it's across time and space. It's a weird thing. On the one hand, I say it's incarnational, local context. I made you think of specific people, not categories of people, but specific people. And yet, it goes across time and space. Have you ever had that experience that I've, especially in worship? We'll sing a hymn and I think, oh, so-and-so is in worship right now too. Or on All Saints Day, and you sing for all the saints. And you just start to, if you're like me, gushing, you know. So-and-so died last year, and so-and-so who wrote it something in the 15th century, and it really means a lot to me. Christian community is not bound by time and space. I would like to read you this whole chapter, but looking for a specific part. It says, this dismisses once and for all every clamorous desire for something more. One who wants more than what Christ has established does not want Christian brotherhood. And the point here is to say that all of this connection that I say starts from Jesus' commandment, that Christian community is distinguished by the fact that it's centered in Christ. It's not that we have tickets to the same symphony. It's not even that we sit in the same bench or the same pew. It's not only that we are from the same family or that we work at the same place or that we like the same music and all and both hate Bach, you know. It does happen. It's all comes from Christ. And that none of those other things are what is distinctive or definitive of Christian community. One who wants more than what Christ has established does not want Christian brotherhood. He is looking for some extraordinary social experience, which he has not found anywhere else. He is bringing muddled and impure desires into Christian brotherhood. Just at this point, Christian brotherhood is threatened most often at the very start by the greatest danger of all, the danger of being poisoned at its root, the danger of confusing Christian brotherhood with some wishful idea of religious fellowship, of confounding the natural desire of the devout heart for community with the spiritual reality of Christian brotherhood. In Christian brotherhood, everything depends upon it being clear right from the beginning. First, that Christian brotherhood is not an ideal, but a divine reality. Not an ideal, but a divine reality. Second, that Christian brotherhood is a spiritual and not a psychic reality. Now, I've just read this as it's translated. I would use community, I think, rather than brotherhood in those places. But Bonhoeffer is taking a particular view of Christian community and saying it's a spiritual reality. Now, the groups we're going to look at push for more than a spiritual reality. They're asking for a particular social incarnation, a very concrete living out of that social reality. Most of us in this room probably don't have what it takes to do that. It's hard work. It's really hard work. One last thing about Christianity and community. We also see it develop across time. That how it starts with those who followed Jesus in his lifetime develops in a multitude of ways. And that's what we're going to be looking at in these next days. Now, I must ask you a question. I have all this stuff about early Christian community. I can say, oops, we didn't quite get to that. Or I can begin to shift and hope that maybe by the third time we'll get caught up, but not have discrete parts. What's your pleasure?
Shift to what?
Can I, if I do early Christian community next time, I probably won't get the monastics done. You see what I mean? But then I do a little of the monastics with the Amish.
Try and squeeze it all in.
I think I could be caught up by Wednesday. That's what I'll try and do. I always think that it will go much more quickly than it does. No, I... we're at our ending time. I'll give you a moment. Oh, Jim Oinas would like to speak before we end.
I'd like to invite you to Vespers tonight at 6:30, which will be next door in the fireside room. And I'd also like to invite you, if you like, to bring your chair in there now when we leave.
That's so
thank you. You're very attentive.